Welcome to another episode of the Hinted Neuron Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kelvin Pascal, and on this week's episode, I talked with Terry Tucker. Terry Tucker is an amazing person. We talked on a range of topics like discipline, hard work, mindset, motivation, and it was an amazing time talking with him. He's done so much, and he was able to share so many stories with me, and I hope you enjoy this podcast as you listen to it. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, don't forget to reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Hinted Neuron. And now, here's my conversation with Terry Tucker. Hello, I'm here with Terry Tucker. Terry Tucker, thanks for coming on the podcast. It's really a pleasure having you here because, you know, you've won many hats in your lifetime, and I really like your story. You've been a basketball coach, you've been in the police, you've chaired like several things, and you have like a managerial experience in different corporate environments. And it's really a diverse thing you've done with your life and your story. You've done so many things, and it's really, I'm really humbled to have you on the podcast. So I just want to pass the mic to you to maybe introduce yourself in your own words so that we can start the podcast.
Well, Kelvin, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today. Sure, a little bit about me. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, one of the larger cities here in the United States. I'm the oldest of three boys. You can't tell this from my voice, but I'm 6'8" tall and actually went to college at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina on a basketball scholarship. When I graduated from college, I'm really going to date myself now, Kelvin, but this is long before the internet was available to help people find employment. So I moved home to find that first job. And I did find it in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain, in their marketing department. That was the good news. The bad news was that I lived with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mother care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. After I left Wendy's, I actually went to work for the hospital that cared for my father and my grandmother. And then at 37 years old, made a major pivot in my life. And as you mentioned, I became a police officer. And part of what I did during that experience was I was a SWAT hostage negotiator. After that, I started a school security consulting business. As you mentioned, I coached girls' high school basketball when we lived in Texas. But for the last 12 years now, I've been battling a rare form of cancer, a rare form of melanoma that's seen multiple amputations. And I currently have tumors in my lungs, which I'm being treated for. And then I guess just finally, my wife and I have been married for 31 years. We have one child, a daughter, who's in the military here in the United States.
Yeah, that's a really good story, Terry. And, you know, you've done so much. And I think one of the things that really caught my interest, I don't know if this is a good place to start, but I wanted to open the Pandora box from there. It's like, as someone who has done so much or always has like a feel for doing something, because it seems as though you're someone who wants to be up and doing, who likes to do stuff, who likes to exert themselves in life. You know, I wonder how it felt for you when you started to go through those rough patches of diagnosis, the treatment plans and all that. I wonder how that must have felt for you, like seeing yourself in that situation.
Yeah, that's a great question. I you know, you're right. I have done a lot of physical things in my life. I played college basketball. I was a police officer. I was on the SWAT team. And now I'm in a wheelchair, having had my left leg amputated right in the middle of the COVID pandemic. So how do you balance those two? And the way I look at it is, when you can't do what you're good at, you do what's important in life. And that's kind of where I feel I am in my life, doing what's important. And, you know, I've seen so many people, Kelvin, in my life that feel that they're born empty, and that when they get out of school and get into life, whatever that looks like for them, that then their job is to fill up their empty self. You know, they've got to get the best employment and make the most money and drive the nicest car and live in the nicest place and have all the latest gadgets and gizmos. And what I found is it's just the opposite. We're not born empty. We're born full. We're born with everything we need to be successful in life, however you define that word success. We just need to find it, pull it out, and use it for our benefit. So our job in life should not be to fill ourselves up. Our job in life should be to empty ourselves out with our unique gifts and talents, certainly for the betterment of ourselves, but also for the betterment of our families, of our friends, of our communities, of our countries. And when you look at life that way, when you look at, I've got to do all this stuff, and the more stuff I get, the happier I'm going to be. And what I found is people aren't happy because there's always one more thing. There's always one more gadget to get. There's always one more job to go after. There's always one more thing. And we always feel that when I get that one thing, then I'll be happy. But you're not, because there's another thing after that, and then another thing after that. So instead of looking at life as to what I can get, look at your life more as what I can give. And it's amazing how your attitude, how your, just the way you feel about yourself, other people, you're happier, you're less stressed, because you're giving of yourself based on unique gifts and talents that you have.
Yeah, what you said is pretty interesting. It reminded me of a time in college where my freshman year of college, and then my friends, they asked me what amount of money would make me happy right now. At the time, I told them a certain amount. You know, at the time it was pretty small. And then, you know, maybe 5 years or 6 years later, after I graduated from the university, and then I thought about that specific moment, I was like, damn. You know, now if you ask me that same question, it's even a bigger amount. You know, it's just like, at the time there was a particular amount that would make me happy. Now there's another bigger amount that would make me happy. And it's just like, I think it was like a mindset shift for me, because it's like, there would always be more and more stuff that I'm going to be reaching out for to, if I kind of hinge my own like happiness on things. Is money and all. Yeah. So I think that really changed my mindset when I started to realize that I think, you know, happiness is just, is not inside of things, you know, or like money. It's just like something that we can create for ourselves every single day and every single day.
You're right. It is. And I remember recently I had a young man who just graduated from college. And he had been a football player at his college, his university. And he reached out to me on LinkedIn and we connected. And he said, could I have a conversation with you? Could I call you? And I said, sure. And so we ended up having this conversation. And he said, you know, I'd like to ask you some questions about this job that I am applying for and what questions you think the hiring manager is going to ask. And I said, well, before we do that, I said, I'd be more than happy to talk to you about that. I said, but let me ask you a question. I said, if there was one thing in your heart, one thing in your soul that you believe you're supposed to do, what would that one thing be? And he thought about it for about 5 seconds. And then he blurted out, he said, I'd be a high school football coach. And I said to him, then why are we talking about a sales job?
Yeah.
And he said to me, because I've got to get money. I've got to make money. And I understand that. I mean, when I graduated from college, I didn't have any money either. You know, and you want to be able to support yourself and things like that. I get that. I totally get that. But you're right. I mean, that how much money is enough? And will you be happy with that? And I've always felt that, you know, if you don't know your worth, if you don't know your values, if you don't know who you are as a human being, you will always default to, I want more money. More money will make me happy. And if you can spend some time not worrying about the money, but thinking about what's important in life to me, what are the things that I feel I've been called to do in this life? And do they match up? How can I match those things up with a job or employment or something like that? Then you start to get into what you really value in your life, what's important to you, and what type of human being you are.
You know, I was thinking, because, you know, on the like topic of, I think, jobs and all. So because, you know, you had like a type of switch where you were like a corporate marketing manager at Wendy's. And I don't know which came first. Okay, I think the corporate marketing manager at Wendy's came before the basketball coach. I wonder what that switch was like. Maybe like what, you know, what maybe made you to make that switch, and what kind of cultural shock you experienced when you made that switch?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you hit the nail right on the head when you said cultural shock. You're right. My first job out of college was in the marketing department at Wendy's. And it wasn't until I was probably in my maybe late 40s that I started to coach high school basketball. And I coached girls high school basketball. And I'd never had that experience of coaching girls, coaching young women. I'd always experienced it coaching boys and men, young men and things like that. So I didn't quite understand. And not that girls aren't competitive. They are incredibly competitive. But they join a team, I think, for a different reason. They join a team for the camaraderie, for the friendship, for the connections that they get with their teammates. Whereas I don't think guys do that specifically. I mean, it may develop. I mean, you may get good friends that are former teammates and things like that. I certainly have from my high school and college days. But I don't think that's their primary reason. They want to get out there and win. And for girls, at least I found in my experience, this may not be true for everybody, that their experience is not so much about winning or losing. It's about the relationships they build with their teammates. And I'll give you an example. We were playing a game. We were right in the middle of the game. And I pointed to one of the girls on the bench. And I motioned for her to go in for another player. And she shook her head yes, like she was going to go in. And out of the corner of my eye, I could see the scorer's table, and she wasn't standing. And so I turned back around and looked at her, and I said, get in the game for so-and-so. She shook her head yes again. And again, I started to concentrate on the game, but out of the corner of my eye, I could see the scorer's table, and she was not there. And finally, I turned to her a third time, and I said, I need you in the game now. And she started shaking her head no, like, I'm not going in the game. I'm like, what? What? You're not going in. We're playing a game. There's a game going out on the court, and you're telling me no. And so I brought her to me, and I said, what's wrong? What's the problem? And immediately the tears started coming down, you know, from her eyes onto her cheeks. And I said, why are you crying? What's the problem? She said, Coach, I don't want to go in the game. And I said, well, why don't you want to go in the game? She said, because my friends are in the stands, and if I make a mistake, they'll laugh at me. And I said, what about your responsibility to your teammates? I mean, you come out here every day at practice and try to make yourself and your teammates better. What about your responsibility to your teammates, the girls that you're sitting next to on the bench? Don't you have a responsibility for them? And I mean, honestly, Calvin, we're having a counseling session right in the middle of a high school basketball game that's going on the court right in front of us. And it was like, I finally got her, or convinced her, I guess, that she had a responsibility to her teammates and that she needed to go into the game. And I said, you know, I know you might make a mistake. I'm not telling you not to make a mistake. I'm just telling you to give me your best effort. If you do that, I'll be very happy, regardless whether we win or lose. Just give me your best effort. And I think that's an important thing that team sports teaches us. It teaches us how to be good teammates. It teaches us, you know, how to do things we're uncomfortable doing, things we don't want to do, things that we're scared about doing, and things like that. Team sports can teach us a lot about ourselves. It can also teach us a lot about life after the game of basketball.
Yeah, what you said, you know, the story you just said right now really resonated with me, because, you know, if I think about some of my, I think, middle school, high school stages where I was sort of afraid most times to try certain things in sport because I was scared that I was going to do it wrong. And I'm going to, like, make a fool of myself by doing it wrong. It's like maybe basketball and soccer and different other, like, sporting things that I wasn't really good at. You know, I wasn't good at really maybe track at all. It's like I can't really do much footwork in soccer. And it's like I'm going to make a fool of myself in the team. And they're going to know that I can't really play. And then it was not until, like, you know, late in my, maybe, like, early 20s that I started to realize that fear of, I think, being in the arena and performing. You know, I really had, like, a significant fear of messing up when I was in the arena that kind of prevented me from, you know, being in any kind of arena sometimes because I'm scared. So, you know, and I wonder for, like, young kids, how can that be, like, mitigated early on for them? I probably know you probably have seen people like me at that age. You probably have, like, coached some of them at that time, but I don't know what advice you would, you know, specifically have for them.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. I think fear in general, regardless of whether we're a young person, middle-aged, old, whatever, fear, I think, is one of the biggest things that is an impediment for us to thinking big, to thinking what it means to be great in our life. And that's the problem. We care too much about what other people think. And you're right. I've had the experience of coaching young people that were in that situation. Coach, I'm afraid. I don't want to play. I don't want to. And I get that. But again, I think it's, what's your responsibility to the other people on your team? And the other thing is, why do you care what other people think when those people have never even tried what you've failed doing? So they've never even tried. They're not out on the court. They're sitting in the stands. You're the one making the effort. You're the one committing to come to practice every day and make yourself and your teammates better. That's what you're doing. What are they doing? They're not doing anything. They're sitting in the stands. So they haven't made that commitment. So I try to put it in terms like that. Like, why do you care what people who have never even attempted what you have failed in, what do you care what they think? What do you care what they say about you and things like that? Because you can always look at them and say, hey, I at least did it. I was the person in the arena. I was the person on the field or the court that was trying. You weren't doing anything. So you can sit and criticize me all you want. You can sit and make fun of me all you want, but what leg do you have to stand on? Because you're not even trying. You're not doing anything out here. So why would I care what somebody who's never tried, what they say? And I think that really is one of the biggest problems that we have in life. We care what other people think. And I think, let me just take that a step further. We also look at other people and say, I want that. And not because we want it, but because they have it. We don't want something, you know, it's like, I'd like to have X, you know, I'd like to have a nicer computer, a nicer laptop, whatever. But I want what he has. Why do you want what he has? Because he has it. It's not like you've thought about the type of laptop you want or you've done the research on it. You want it because they have it. You know, you want the amount of money that person makes, not because the money is going to make you happy, but because they have it. And I think that's, again, where we get in trouble. We all have our own journey. We all have our own road to travel. And where we get off course is when we start trying to live someone else's life, or we start trying to get the things that other people have just because they have them. There's nothing wrong with wanting things in life. There's nothing wrong with saying, I want a new laptop. That's fine. But there is something wrong with saying, I want something because somebody else has it. That doesn't make you them. You shouldn't try to be like them. Whatever journey they're on, why can't you just be happy for them? You know, they've worked for something. They've achieved something. They've been given something. Be happy for them. and stay on your path, stay on your journey, and do the things that you're supposed to do. We're not supposed to, I'm not supposed to do what you're doing. You're not supposed to be doing what I'm doing. We each have our unique journey. And when you have success, I'm happy for you. I want you to have success. I want you to be happy in life. I don't have to tear you down to build myself up. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. And, you know, it just really reminded me of something I was thinking about, I think a few years ago, when I started to make some observations of certain people who would pivot all the time when they see other people, like maybe they see something that's working for someone and then they pivot what they're doing and just like go try what the other person is doing because they think that that would work for them. So they're never really onto any type of consistent thing for themselves. They're always changing course of like, oh, that worked for this person. Maybe I should try it. This worked for that person. Maybe I should start to do that. And they're just like always never really in a consistent road towards, you know, one thing long term. They're just always changing based on like, I think what they see other people do. And I think, you know, as like young people, I think that can be, like maybe as like a young person, that can be really derailing because like some of them that I saw or I made observations on at the time never really had any specific skills or like talents that they've like nurtured for a while. You know, they're just always changing based on what's new and what they see is working for someone.
Yeah, and you know, you make a great point. And I know certainly in my life, and maybe you can talk to this as well, you know, we tend to think that, you know, we've got certain arbitrary benchmarks where we say, okay, you know, I'm 32 years old and I don't have the job I want. I'm not making the money that I want. You know, I thought I'd be married by now. I thought I'd have a family by now. And so we tend to say, well, gee, our life is a failure. You know, our life is not going the direction that we wanted it to go. And I think when we look at those small individual benchmarks, that we tend to get down on those. And I heard somebody, wish I could remember where I heard this, but he talked about looking at our lives instead of in the abstract like that, like one single event here and there. He said, look at your life in decades. For example, in your 20s, do everything. Try anything that you think even remotely seems to be interesting to you. Get involved, make mistakes, volunteer for certain things, go to certain things that I don't know if I'd like that play or that music or whatever. Just do everything in your 20s. And then he said in your 30s, you look at life more like, what are the two or three things that I really enjoy, that I want to dig into, that I really want to get my hands dirty, that I really want to work as part of? And then he said in your 40s, find that one thing. Because in your 40s, you're more established, you've got more experience, you're more mature. Find that one thing in your 40s. And then in your 50s and your 60s, you can reap the benefits of the work that you did more in your 30s or your 40s. And I like that way of looking at life because you don't pigeonhole yourself to say, well, by 32, I need to be making, you know, $150,000 a year and I need to be married and I need to have two kids. And when you don't, then you tend to look at your life as, well, I'm not where I thought I was supposed to be. But that's an arbitrary, timeline. You're just saying by this date, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's just you pick the date. By the time I'm 32 or 34 or 35, I want to be here. Well, you're not there. But look at your life in decades, and I think it opens you up to more possibilities to saying, okay, I'm 32, but I'm not married yet. That's okay. I still got the rest of the decade. I still got 8 more years to figure that out. So you don't pigeonhole yourself to a place where it's like, I'm not happy because I'm not meeting an arbitrary benchmark that I set for myself.
Yeah, and I think maybe to a great degree, for some people, there's like maybe some societal like expectations that would make them box themselves like that. Just try to, you know, maybe based on what they see in society as what's quote unquote might be normal. So they don't want to like follow those normal things, and then they're just scared to deviate from or like follow their own track of what they feel is good for them. They kind of want to like, oh, this is how people, some people have done it. Let me just do it like that, something like that. I don't know if it takes, you know, specific types of mindset to be able to see that, you know, I don't need to do all that, you know, because that's how some people do it. Like, do my own thing, do what I want to. But let me just take a tangent here right now, because I'm really interested in your time as like a hostage negotiator, and I wanted to know, I think, what was some of like your memorable experience during that time. If you had like come across really interesting characters and or great experiences or bad experiences that you would like to share.
Yeah, I think as a police officer in general, you do come across a lot of characters, a lot of people that, you know, you're kind of like, oh, I don't know if mom would be real proud of you right now, but hey, that's okay. You've got to make your own decisions. Hostage negotiating was very interesting for me because I learned a lot about how we as human beings communicate with each other. And I'll give you an example. So when I first started, I was given a formula of how human beings communicate with each other. And that formula was 7, 38, 55. So 7% of how we communicate a message to another person are the words that we use. And how many times have we said, you know, we've said something and you're like, ooh, maybe I shouldn't have said that, or maybe I should have said it in a different way. That's only 7% of how you communicate a message. 38% is the tone of voice that you use with that message. And then 55% of how we communicate a message to another person is our body language and our facial expressions. So understanding that formula and realizing that if somebody has barricaded themselves in their house, in a business or something like that, and they have a gun, we're not in the room with them. We are many times talking to them either outside or even blocks away on the phone. So what we did not have was the luxury of that 55%. So if I said something to them, I couldn't see them kind of roll their eyes and be like, oh, I can't believe he said that to me. He's so off base. So we had to get good at figuring things out, certainly based on what people were saying, but also what they weren't saying and how they were saying it. And the overarching theme of all this is trust. And Kelvin, you know this. I mean, any relationship you have in your life, whether you know it's with a friend, whether it's with your parents, your siblings, your boss, the overarching theme, if that's a good relationship, is trust. Can I trust this person? Do they trust me? And so trust is huge. But we're trying to negotiate with a person who's obviously having probably one of the worst, if not the worst, day of their life. And we have no idea why we're there. We've never met this person. We have no idea what their background is, what their education is, what got them to the point where they took a gun and barricaded themselves, or they took a hostage. So we had to start basically using what we call tactical empathy. Now, I think you can get rid of the word tactical and just talk about empathy. In other words, if I was negotiating with you, Kelvin, it would be like, well, Kelvin, help me to understand where you're coming from. And again, the important word there is understand, not agree. I'm not going to agree with you. If you were a homicide suspect that just murdered three people, I wasn't going to agree with you. But I did need to understand, because understanding builds trust, and trust leads to getting to a point where I can hopefully suggest things that will get you to come out safely.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because it's like there's a thing you talked about, like even earlier, talking about like relationships and like how almost everything like boils down to that, like you were speaking of that. So it's interesting because, you know, I was thinking about how in that moment of negotiating with a person, you're trying to form, you know, at that very moment, some type of relationship with this person in some ways that would make them trust you, them to like give you maybe information that you want that could be helpful, or for them to, you know, or just to help some type of event happening around that time. So it seems to me that that trait of, you know, building that type of instant relationship in that spot is like a really significant skill, you know. And I don't know if that also translates to, I think, leadership in some ways, or making people trust you, because you held some leadership positions in your life. So you probably have had like difficult situations with maybe people that were like under your managerial like role or something. So I kind of wonder how that translates between the two, building relationships, having people trust you, and having people be able to come to you or something like that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right. I mean, trust is developed by being a person of character, a person of integrity, of doing what you say you're going to do. And for example, when we were negotiators, people would say to us all the time, hey, I'll come out, but you have to promise me that I'm not going to go to jail. And we would have to say to them, well, I'm sorry, when you do come out, you are going to go to jail. And we never lied to people. And there's really no magic bullet on this, but the reason we never lied to people was there was a very good chance, and this happened over my career, where a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, we would be right back negotiating with this person, because the underlying problem, say it was their mother, say their mother was just nagging them and, you know, never liked what they did and was never happy for them or positive, had anything positive to say to them. And that caused them to finally reach a breaking point and take a gun and barricade themselves in their room. So mom was the problem. Well, mom hasn't gone away, so the problem is still there. And 1, 2, 3 years from now, we're negotiating with them again. And if they ever felt that we lied to them, that we said something that wasn't true, then we've lost that trust. We've lost that credibility, and we were going to have to bring in another negotiator to talk to them. So trust is incredibly important. And that's just being a person of your word. That's saying when I say I'm going to do something, then you're going to do it. And so many people figure out, especially in business, that where can I really get away with not working very hard? They don't like the grind, so to speak. They don't love the work. And so they just kind of, they do what they need to do, but they actually don't, they're not really utilizing their talents. They're just, it's a paycheck to them. That's all they care about. And that's okay for a lot of people. I mean, we talk about purpose in life, and we think our purpose has to be our job or our occupation. It doesn't. Now, if it works out that it is, that's great for you, but it doesn't. I mean, your job could be over here. It's what you do to pay the bills, but your purpose is over here. Your passion is over here. You want to paint, or you want to write, or you want to be an activist, or whatever you decide you want to do. So, and I heard this saying one time that said, never follow your passion, but bring it with you everywhere you go. And I like that saying. I mean, your passion is an emotion, and we shouldn't make decisions on our emotions. And I can use an example. When I was a hostage negotiator, we've all been to the park when we were kids, and we played on like the teeter-totter or the seesaw. And that was exactly what negotiating was like. We would start, and the person we were negotiating with, one end of their teeter-totter, their emotional end, would be way up in the air, and they would be yelling and screaming and ranting and raving. And over time, by asking open-ended questions and how and what questions, we would get them to burn off a lot of that emotional energy to the point where the teeter-totter would come sort of to equilibrium. And then again, by continuing to talk to them, asking them more questions, we would hopefully get to the point where their rational brain was up in the air and their emotional brain was way down on the ground. And that's when we started talking about solutions to the problem, getting them to put the gun down, letting the hostages go, coming out and things like that. Because we all make better decisions with our rational brains more so than we do with our emotional brains. When we're emotional, we don't necessarily make good decisions. When we're rational, we make better decisions for ourselves.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, I've realized, I think in myself, and I think in a number of people, it's like, you know, because I want to make good decisions. You know, I think most of my daily life involves making tiny decisions here and there, even in research or in my life. You know, I need to make a certain type of decision, and I want to be able to make the best judgment in a particular case scenario. And it's like, you know, if my mind is not in the right place, I would make a mistake. And, you know, I don't know if it's a good trait, but in some ways I'm scared of making a mistake because of bad decision making. And then it's like I'm always trying to optimize for the right state of mind in some ways, or trying to avoid things that could lead me down a path where my decision making or my judgment would, you know, be flawed. And I don't know if that's something, I guess, that can be taught, because I see that in society today, there are like some decisions that, you know, it's just based on observation. People, you know, you see people make certain decisions and it's like, you know, that's not the best judgment. Or like, you know, they had good options as well, but they didn't make the best decision in that scenario. So I was like, you know, is decision making something that can be taught, or does it have really to do with how someone's mind and emotion works?
You know, I always tell people to never make an important life decision when you're emotional. In other words, you know, don't make an important life decision if your boss just told you, you know, you're never getting promoted, or somebody close to you died, or I don't know, you know, one of your friends moved away and you're feeling really down, you know, your best friend moved away and you're feeling down and stuff like those emotional times. Never make decisions. You know, somebody says something, you know, you get fired from your job. Well, I'm going to go to work for that company. Well, is that the best decision for you? Do you really want to go to work for that company? Or is it just there and it's low hanging fruit so you can grab it? So I always caution people, never make important life decisions when you're in an emotional state. You know, somebody dies, you get married, you get divorced, you have a baby, you get let go from your job, you find out you have a chronic or a terminal illness. Those are all life-changing events. And you should not make an immediate decision after those events, in my opinion, because you're using your emotional brain at that point in time. There's a lot of things going on. Wait till things settle down, till you're in a more normal state, and then make your decisions. Because like I said, we make better decisions for ourselves when we're thinking rationally, not when we're thinking emotionally. You know, I just divorced my wife, and you know what? I'm going to go take that job on the other side of the country. And you move and you take the job and you get there and you're like, what the heck did I just do? That wasn't a good deal for me. I made that decision kind of in a knee-jerk reaction based on an emotional event in my life. So I think you can make good decisions if, one, you spend some time thinking about them. And time is something we all have plenty of. You know, think about what the decision you want to make is, and then make sure you're not making that decision from an emotional point of view. Is it the best thing for you? Is it something that's good for you? For example, somebody asked me, one of the nurses who cares for me is thinking about getting married. And she said, you know, what do you think are the most important things that I should look at? You know, I said, there's a myriad of things you should look at. I said, but let me give you two things to think about. Number one, if you want to marry this person, first of all, are your metrics better? Are you smarter because you're with this person? Are you financially better off because you're with this person? Do you have better friends because you're with this person? All kinds of things. Those are the kind of, are you better? Are you a better person with them than you would be without them? And then the second thing I told her was, would you go to war with this person? Would you go into combat with this person? Would this person be with you basically when the bullets started flying, when things got really hard and tough in your lives? Because things are going to get hard and tough in your lives, especially if you're married for a long period of time. Is that person going to stick with you? Are they going to stay with you? Are they going to support you and love you and care about you no matter how bad things get? No matter if you lose your job, no matter if you get sick and you're dying, are they going to be there for you? I said, look at those two things to start with, and then add in, you know, your philosophies on religion and money and children and all kinds of things like that. So, you know, that's kind of a rambling answer to your question, but hopefully it answered it.
No, that's pretty good. I really like the theme you said, and you know, another thing that even stuck out for me is just like a tiny detail there sort of your response was the thing you talked about time and how we have plenty of it. And like how, because, you know, I see a lot of people, they say that, you know, there's no time for this, there's no time for that, or like they have less time because they're too busy. And, you know, I've never really understood that in some ways. You know, I think for myself, I do so much, but like the feeling of maybe something that I really want to do, telling myself I do not have time, you know, I don't know why. That kind of, I don't know, like, why is it that for some people there's just no time? Or is it a matter of, and most times I don't even think about it in terms of priorities. You know, it's just more what needs to be done should be done in some ways.
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess I would say, look at the things you spend your time on. And I would venture to say, I mean, if you actually just pulled out a piece of paper and said, okay, here was what I did today. You know, I got up at this point in time. I got ready for work. I ate breakfast. I didn't work out in the morning. Oh, okay. Well, can I work out in the afternoon? Oh, there's no time for that. I don't have any time to work out. Oh, okay. Well, what if you went to bed an hour earlier and got up an hour earlier? Maybe you could work out in the morning if that's important to you. You know, what did I eat today? How much time did I spend on social media? How much time did I spend, you know, doing stupid things, you know, watching television or Netflix? I'm not telling you not to relax. Absolutely, you should relax in your life, have some downtime. It kind of gets your brain fog out of the way and allows you to focus better. But if you would really look at the amount of time you spend on social media, the amount of time you spend watching TV, the amount of time you just spend being lazy and not doing anything productive, then you would probably look at that list like, oh my gosh, there are all kinds of places in there where I could find more time to eat better, to spend more time with my family, which is important to me, or my friends, which is important to me, to exercise, to improve my mind. What am I going to, I want to read. I want to read more. I want to read a book. When I don't have time to read. Well, why can't you set aside 30 minutes before you go to bed to read a book, to read part of a book or a magazine or something like that? So, I mean, the amount of time that we waste, and I am absolutely guilty of this myself, where, you know, you do something on social media and, you know, 30 minutes goes by and you're like, well, that was 30 minutes of time that I'll never get back again, but was a total waste. It provided me no value. So what value are you adding to your own life? We always talk about value in terms of adding value to your job or adding value to your friends or to your family. What value are you adding to yourself? What are you doing to make yourself better person emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually? What are you doing to make yourself a better person?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good response, because, you know, something that even, you know, I think for myself, like you said, I'm also guilty of, you know, sometimes you just do something and it's just like, what did I get out of this? You know, it's like, oh, this is not even really the thing I plan to do at this particular moment. Yeah, I think it's something that would not be. But yeah, I wanted to go back to, I think, something you had said earlier in the conversation, because I remembered a time in my life. You know, I was in my third year of university, and I studied industrial chemistry at the university. And then there was a time I was doing this particular semester, I was doing 18-hour labs every week. And it was a very intense period, very painful and stressful. And I was doing a lot of work, assignments, lab reports for different labs, different classes and all. It's like a very stressful time. I would come home with so much pain in my legs from standing in the lab for 6 hours sometimes in the day. And, you know, it was really painful. And then I was trying to, like, keep up with all the work. And then there was a day that I was walking back to my hostel. And then, you know, I just fell on the floor. And two guys came, they rushed me to the clinic on their back. They just, like, jacked me up on their back and rushed me to the clinic. And then, you know, on that sick bed, I began to cry. I think the reason I began to cry was more, I think, because I was like, oh, what's the point of all this, in the sense of, like, imagine if I just, like, died. It's like, imagine, I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't eating well. I was being stressed. It's like, what if something bad happened to me? Then it's just like, all that is for waste. And then I started to cry because of that realization. So I kind of wanted to, you know, ask you, because you talked about something, about some type of realization you came in once you, like, had your diagnosis of, like, if something similar, if it was kind of similar in that sense of, like, you coming to that type of realization of, oh, well, you know, maybe there's, like, a different approach in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously were in a situation where, you know, there are things in life that you want to do, but you know they're going to be incredibly demanding on you, you know, going to law school, going to medical school, working on your graduate degrees and stuff like that. You're going to spend a lot of time basically beating up your body. And you're right. You're going to do that. I think you know that going into it. Okay, I'm going to stress myself now when I'm young so that hopefully, you know, I'm going to do the hard things now so that down the road I will have an easier time. But you also have to be smart about it. I mean, your body is an incredibly, incredibly hard machine to break. I've seen the body have a lot of damage, whether it's being shot. I've seen people shot four or five times up walking around. They're just talking to you and stuff like that. And they have four or five bullets in because they didn't hit anything critical and stuff like that. So the body can take a lot of damage and keep going on. But you're right. And you experienced it. You got to a point where, okay, I can't go on anymore. I have not treated my body well. And again, that's kind of stepping back and looking and say, okay, I am really killing myself in these labs. I'm doing 18-hour labs. I'm really pushing myself. Well, how can I make my body better on the other end? Am I eating right? Am I getting enough rest? When can I sleep? When should I sleep? Well, I don't want to go to bed at 7 o'clock at night. I'm going to stay up and hang out with my friends for a while. That's a choice you make. You don't hang out with your friends. You go to bed at 7 o'clock. You're more well rested and things like that. So you have a choice on how you want to do this. And I would say that, you know, a lot of young people, they really hit it hard, you know, in college and graduate school and on for different law school, medical school, things like that. They hit it hard and they understand that they're going to physically hurt themselves, but there's going to be a reward on the back end if you can manage all that stress. And I'll end with this story. And this is a true story that happened back in the 1950s at Johns Hopkins University here in the United States. There was a professor who did an experiment with rats. And he took rats and he put them in a tank of water that was over their head. And he wanted to see how long the average rat treaded water. And the average rat treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as those rats were getting ready to sink and drown, he reached in, grabbed them, pulled them out, dried them off, and let them rest for a while. And then he took the exact same rats and put them back in that exact same tank of water. And the second time around, on average, those rats treaded water for 60 hours. Now think about that. The first time, 15 minutes. Now, it's not like your business is going to fail or you're going to flunk a test. No, you're going to die. Your life is going to be over. And the second time, 60 hours, which taught me two things. Number one, the importance of hope in our lives, that if we know we're motivated, we're disciplined, and we have good habits, that more than likely, maybe not today, maybe not this month, maybe not even this year, but at some point in time, there's a better than average chance we're going to get to where we need to be. But the second thing it taught me is what I just was talking about, how much more our physical bodies can handle than we ever thought they could. We quit, we give up, we give in long before our physical bodies do, because our brains are telling us, hey, this hurts, this is uncomfortable, I don't like this, stop doing it, and we quit. But just like a marathon runner talks about hitting that wall at some point in time, or I just don't think I can go on, what they find is if they can continue to move forward, eventually they break through that wall, they get a second energy, a second wind, so to speak, and they're able to finish the race. Our bodies are like that. We quit because we don't like the pain. Instead of running from that pain, take that pain, use it, flip it inside of you, burn it as fuel, use it as energy to make you stronger and more resilient.
Yeah, I think that's really solid advice. I mean, you know, it's things that for myself, I could use as well, and also people who listen. But we're going to round up in a bit, but I know you have a book, Sustainable Excellence.
Right.
I wanted you to talk on that right now, and you know, what's about, what's expected if the listener buys the book or I buy the book.
Sure. So Sustainable Excellence was a book that I never expected to write. I never wanted to write a book. I never thought about writing a book. There's kind of an old joke that says when we talk to God, it's called prayer. When God talks to us, it's called schizophrenia. So God has never told me to write a book, but I have a very strong faith in God. And I think what God does is put people in our path that start making the same suggestion over and over and over again. And I had enough people that were saying, Terry, you should write a book. Terry, you should write a book. So I spent some time thinking, well, maybe I should write a book. Maybe all these people saying that is God's way of kind of telling me you should write a book. And Sustainable Excellence is really a book that's born out of two conversations that I had. One was with a former player that I had coached when I was a high school basketball coach, who had moved to the area in Colorado where my wife and I live with her fiance. And the four of us had dinner one night. And I remember saying to her after dinner that I was excited that she was living close and I could watch her find and live her purpose. And Kelvin, she got very quiet for a while. And then she looked at me and she said, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? And I said, I have absolutely no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about. Finding the reason or reasons you were put on the face of this earth. And there is a reason or reasons, using your unique gifts and talents and living those reasons. So that was one conversation. And then I had a young man reach out to me from college on social media, and he asked me what I thought were the most important things that he should learn, not to just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And I didn't want to give him the sort of cliches that we all know, you know, get up early, work hard, help others. I didn't want to give him that. I wanted to go deeper with it. So I spent some time and I was taking some notes and eventually came up with these sort of 10 ideas, these 10 thoughts, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I stepped back and I was like, well, I got a life story that fits underneath this principle, or I know somebody whose life emulates that principle. So literally during the 4 to 5 month period where I was healing after I had my leg amputated, I sat down at the computer and I built stories. And they're real stories about real people underneath each of the 10 principles. And that's how the book Sustainable Excellence came to be.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think it's a really good experience. You know, the narration you told, even especially for me, I'm beginning to learn something, because for me, I think I like stories. I like to collect stories. I like to write them. And I like to observe and like write what I observe. And it's like, you know, I think for me, there's always been this excuse of, you know, I'm doing some other things. And it's like, you know, that's no good excuse not to write. Because I want to write, I want to share certain things I've learned from people, talking to people, from observing, or even from my own life. It's like you writing a book at that stage is enough motivation for me to actually, you know, get my ass to writing sometime as well. Yeah.
You know, I think we should all have a writing practice. And there have been times, I'll be honest with you, where people have said, you know, what do you think about X? And I'll be honest with you, like, I don't know what I think about it because I haven't even thought about it.
Yeah.
And where I find I get clarity is if I sit down and just start to write about whatever X is, you know, the economy or sports or whatever. And I start to write things out. And I think your thoughts sort of crystallize or come together when you write things in life. And so I think we should all have a writing practice, whether we publish it in a book or whether we just use it for ourselves to get clarity on things that we are interested in our life.
Yeah, pretty good. I really love that advice. There's a question that everybody gets to answer on the podcast, and that question is, what's the meaning of life?
What's the meaning of life? That's a great question. I will say this. I'm going to say the meaning of life is two things. One is love, and the other is connection. And the reason I talk about connection is one of the nurses who cares for me when I get my treatments for the tumors I have in my lungs is a former hospice nurse. And for those of your audience who don't know about hospice, it's people who take care of others at the end of their life. It's end of life care. And she recommended a book to me. And the book was called Imagine Heaven. And it's a book about people who have near-death experiences. And there are a lot of interesting things in the book, but the main takeaway I found from it was this. No matter who the person who had the near-death experience saw during their experience, whether it was, you know, Jesus or Allah or a saint or an angel or a friend or a relative, almost everyone got asked one question. And that question was, how do you treat my people? And being Christian, and I know there's probably listeners out there that aren't, and I understand that, but being Christian, you look at the point, I think it's John's gospel in the Bible, where Jesus is asked, what's the most important commandment? And he says, have no other gods but me, love your God above everything else. And then he says, and the second is just like it, love your neighbor as yourself. So I think that's what that one question was about. How do you treat my people? How do we treat each other? How do we care about each other? How do we support each other? How do we help each other? How do we love each other? And if the meaning of life for me is anything, I mean, 100 years from now, nobody's even going to remember that I was here, and that's okay. But what I want the meaning of life to be today, now, is the connections that I have with other people, the love that I have for other people to try to make their lives better.
Yeah, I think that's a really amazing point, and it's something I've started to implement in my life, you know, for a while now, just, you know, putting myself in service to others, just giving as much as I can and helping people in the ways that I can. It's not just about myself. It's about what I can do, how I can be of help, how I can come through for people. Yeah, I think that's, those are like really amazing points. But, you know, I think to round up now, it's been really lovely having you on the podcast. I think it's been a great conversation. I've learned a few things, and I think people who listen will learn as well. And, you know, I just want to thank you for your time and all your knowledge. And I would link your, I think you have a website that I would link to, and I think your book that I should probably also link to, so where people can find you. I don't know if there is any other thing you want to say, Terry.
No, I think that, that's it. I guess I'll leave your audience with this one line. Ernest Hemingway, one of our greatest writers here in the United States, wrote a book called Farewell to Arms. And he has a great line in the book. And I think it applies to all of us at some point in our lives. And the line is this: life breaks everyone, and afterward, many are stronger at the broken places. So just like if you were to break your arm and they put it in a cast, that area where that break was would heal stronger than it was before. That same metaphor applies to all of us for life, that we have hard times in life, but if we keep going, we'll be stronger people because of that. So I'll leave it at that. Kelvin, thank you very much for having me on. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you for listening to the end. And as I always say, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, don't forget to reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Interneuron. That's it for me this week. And until next time, stay curious.